The Sabbath day and our treatment of it and our doctrinal handling of it have come up from time to time in the past as a question. A number have asked about it. There are a number of things that have been questioned. We have the new website offers a number of fabulous ways of getting answers very quickly. They have a topics header up above. You can click on the topic. Pick almost any of the major topics that we talk about in the church, and it'll take you to almost every piece of literature we've ever produced on that subject. And you can go through, and then there are archives besides that go back a number of years as well. It'll take you to all the current literature on it, and then the archives will take you even further back if you want to go back. I went back just to see if any of my ancient articles on the Good News were still there, and they were. But it'll take you almost anywhere to get answers on things like that. And at the moment, we have made no changes to doctrine, even though there have been some in the past who have accused us of making changes to doctrine. There are some, I think, who are suspicious that we're secretly making doctrinal changes, but you really can't do that. I don't know how you would go about doing that. Just recently, I went to our website and I pulled up our Constitution, which lists our basic fundamental 20 basic doctrines of the church, and nothing on that website that I can tell has changed either. To change those requires of a vote of three-quarters of the GCE, and no such vote has taken place, so I would assume we're not changing any doctrines, even though some might accuse us of doing so. The suspicion, I guess, for some is that we're changing doctrines, I believe, maybe comes from a misconception about decision-making and judgments. Judgments are a subject that sometimes people don't have a real good grasp on or an understanding of them, and I don't want to quibble about some of those decisions in the past and some of the decisions we've made or not made. What I want to talk about or what I'd like to address is, does the church have the right to make decisions like that? Do we have that authority, that permission, so to speak, from God to make some of those decisions, and to regarding how we observe some of the doctrines that we find? Does the church have the right to do so when the situation calls for it? The church has two doctrinal committees. Just for your information, I'll give a little bit of background on that so people understand a little more about it. Three members of the Council of Elders are the first and primary doctrinal committee. That's usually what, when somebody says doctrinal committee, that's what people are referring to. They change periodically as members on the council change. Sometimes the doctrinal committee members or even the chairman of the committee will change around to someone else. It's currently Mr. Bob Berendt is the chairman of the doctrinal committee on the council. They are assisted by what we call a doctrinal advisory committee, which consists of seven members who vote on anything really complicated before forwarding it on to the three members of the doctrinal committee of the council. And they're backed up by an additional 13 men who are on standby and who kind of watch and study and listen and learn as the doctrines are discussed or changed, or not changed, but I shouldn't say that, as the doctrines are discussed and as we review papers and things that come in having to do with doctrine. And they learn that process so that if any of the seven members drop off, they can pick someone from the 13 to go back on the seven-member team. I'm at the moment one of the seven, so usually I see whatever is coming out on doctrine or is being considered for change, or if the committee is editing a change in a letter or something that we're writing, usually I will see that as well. The Doctrinal Advisory Committee basically does a lot of the grunt work and grunt writing for the council. In other words, so that their time is not consumed too steadily, but at this point, Mr. Berendt seems to enjoy doing a lot of the grunt work, so we haven't been as active in helping as we could be at the moment. But the Doctrinal Advisory Committee usually does most of the research and writing and the correspondence in order to submit it to the Doctrinal Committee of the Council. things dealing with issues involved that are not difficult or not critical. Oftentimes, we write up an answering letter to people who have sent in a paper, and then the council approves it, and they sign off on it, and they send it from the council. They review those letters and papers, and we just kind of help them do that. If the three-man doctrinal committee of the council, presently chaired by Mr. Barrett, feels that a decision needs to be made that actually affects our major doctrines in some way, they can call for it to be placed on the ballot of the GCE for that following meeting in the spring. But I've never actually seen anything go on to the ballot for the GCE to vote on that was an actual doctrinal change. That just doesn't happen very often. Usually there's some there's something wrong with the papers or the suggestions that come in, typically, and so we don't change doctrine easily. Now back to the question, does the church have the right to make judges or judgments or changes or render decisions about how we observe or understand and keep the doctrines of the church? Well, yes and no. It can go either way. No, in that we cannot change doctrine. We cannot change what the Bible teaches. But yes, in terms of making decisions on how that process sometimes is carried out. Moses made judgments about the laws of God. God gave the Ten Commandments to him. He gave some judgments with them. And then Moses added a number of judgments to what God had already given. But he did it before God, and he had the authority to do so, and God supported the decisions that he made in those judgments. They were, in effect, you know, at that time, Moses was the one who was acting as the judge of Israel. Jesus Christ also gave this decision-making authority to all of his apostles, not just to Peter, as some believe. But they were the ministry of the early church. And today we don't necessarily follow or allow individual ministers to make changes in how we observe doctrines. They have to be made by the council, or if serious, they have to be then approved by 75% of the GCE each year, the General Conference of Elders. In the Bible, these decisions are called judgments. And we find that Moses was probably the first man to make judgments and record them, at least, both from God and before God. And I doubt any of us would say that Moses didn't have the right to make those judgments. Obviously, they're recorded in Scripture for us, so obviously God didn't approve them and allow them. Many of them are recorded. If you look in Exodus 21 through 24, you'll find most of the judgments listed, even a few at, I think, maybe at the tail end of Exodus 20. But immediately after the Ten Commandments are given in Exodus 20 is where the judgments begin to be rolled out. Perhaps we need to examine and consider the process involved in making proper judgments throughout time and by the appropriate method. The Sabbath being an issue that came up recently, the church has a doctrinal paper on it, and we frequently, when issues came up about certain doctrines, wrote papers. Sometimes they were called doctrinal papers, sometimes they were called doctrinal study papers. We have various names for them, but usually they are published by the church and approved by the council of elders. And one of those papers was called Beginning of the Sabbath in Extreme Northern and Southern Regions. It was published in 2004 and approved by the council. And that's an example that I want to use for just a moment in terms of how we make judgments and why we have to make certain judgments regarding the keeping of certain doctrines. A letter was sent to a pastor not too long ago, and I'll read some from the letter here as he writes it, because he was kind of curious, you know, what was going on too and how we were making decisions. But he said, "Awakening to a new day, I looked out the window to a black sky filled with pinpoints of light. Above snow-covered mountains as a meteorite made a slow burn to the horizon. the long nights here in Alaska, where we have been visiting, are lengthening. Eventually, the sun will never rise or set for an eight-week period in the northern parts of this state. Living in the dark there, one loses his ability to sense when a day begins or ends. Next year, during the summer months, this phenomenon will reverse itself until the sun perpetually circles overhead for 2 months again. Each of us will judge angels one day. And if you haven't done so already, think about how to answer a person's question who's asking, how do I keep the Sabbath in Alaska? If you think about that, what instructions would you want to give? Now, this is one of the simpler judgments that had to be rendered in terms of how we keep the Sabbath in the Arctic Circle. And Alaska, of course, is the largest U.S. state, yet it is very sparsely populated. Many towns that get isolated during the seasonal storms and winter events. A church member living in a remote village was once its sole physician, who could set broken bones, revive the drowned, restore the nearly frozen, treat pneumonia patients, help the sick, recover, etc. This is being written by a pastor, excuse me, in Alaska. And he's asking, how did we decide to come up with the various judgments that we have rendered? And if you haven't done so already, what would you tell this physician? What does he do? He's the only physician in a town in this remote area of Alaska. The town is snowed in. There's no such thing as taking people out to a hospital. What's he supposed to do when somebody comes to him on the Sabbath? Supposed to say, I'm sorry, this is my day off. I can't help you. Some of these decisions had to be rendered. Judgments had to be made. And these are just two examples that he names in his letter. What does he do? What would you tell him to do? We have members in a certain country whose government takes children of church members away who do not allow them to attend school on the Sabbath and makes them wards of the state. How would you like to be the one who tells that family that you really need to observe the Sabbath and say goodbye to your children when the state finds out? How would you feel as a minister making judgments like that in an area like that? That's another extreme example of some things that we have to encounter in terms of making decisions. In other countries, those who have children who are taking are required to take their final exams on the Sabbath in certain countries for high school graduation. Can you make a judgment about what those members should do regarding their children and the Sabbath? It would not be easy to make some of those decisions, would it? Graduation ceremonies often occur on Sabbaths, as do weddings and funerals in many families and family members who are not in our church. Some non-church families hold their families' reunions only in connection with religious holidays. The proper timing of the observance of Passover and Pentecost can seem very uncertain in Scripture to some. If you don't accept the Hebrew calendar, how do you calculate the holy days? How do you tell when to observe the holy days? Even the postponements that are part of the calendar can affect the Feast of Tabernacles by an entire month. If you don't accept the postponements or the Hebrew calendar the way it is, what do you do? Dining out on the Sabbath. We have a doctrinal paper study paper on that one as well. It involves work by those who cook and serve. Taxes paid by members in certain countries alleviate all the needs intended to be covered by third tithe. So what do you tell people to do in very poor countries in regard to third tithe when everything's covered by the government? Contractors often require the construction work on members' homes and church buildings continue on Saturdays in some countries. What do you do? Some fish have scales during only a portion of their lives. How do you make the judgment regarding whether they're clean or not? Are they clean or not? Bank interest and rental profits are earned every hour of every day of the week. And so if you work in a bank, you're making money on the Sabbath. even if you're not there in the bank working. How do you decide whether to work there or not? You know, judgments on those sorts of things have to be rendered. Some drugs, some vitamins, minerals, food additives, gelatins, etc., include trace elements and byproducts derived from glands or shells of unclean animals. If you haven't done so already, think about the judgment you would make regarding those. What do you do? When you think about it, it's not so easy to make judgments, is it? God commands his people to keep his commandments, to keep his statutes and his judgments. In Deuteronomy 26, let's turn over there. A couple of verses here I want to take a look at. First one is in Deuteronomy 26. Deuteronomy chapter 26 and verse 16. This day the Lord your God has commanded you to do these statutes and judgments. You shall therefore keep and do them with all your heart and with all your soul. God is seeking for us to be an obedient people. Leviticus 19:37, very similar comment is made by God. Leviticus 19 and verse 37. Therefore shall you observe all my statutes and all my judgments and do them. I am the Lord. And the people of Israel in Exodus chapter 24 agreed to do these things that God commanded. Let's go over to Exodus 24. Read where God's people agreed to obey God. Exodus 24 and verse 3. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord hath said, we will do. We will do. And here we are actually seeing the covenant, the old covenant being made with God, or being signed into law, or the covenant being agreed to with God, however you want to put it. These laws and the statutes and the judgment overshadow basically every aspect of our human lives in one way or another. Many are not specific, and many of the laws that God gave are not as specific as we need them to be, so sometimes judgments have to be rendered in how we will treat that doctrine or that commandment that God has given in every circumstance, in every age. And those judgments are a necessary thing. In each new epoch of time that goes by, things change, issues change, decisions have to be made again as time goes by in order to observe and to continue to observe God's laws. And the complexity, of course, there's the myriad of complexity of some of these issues that go by and conditions that change in local governments. All of those things affect how we understand the keeping of God's law. And conditions that are caused by those local governments or authorities or conflicting laws or seasons, time zones, speed, direction of travel, all kinds of things change over time. If you happen to be an astronaut orbiting the Earth, how do you keep the Sabbath? You know, when does sunset start and stop? You know, those kinds of things, those are just silly little things that need judgments sometimes. We don't have anybody who's an astronaut doing that, but there are all kinds of areas of life, and I'm going to mention a few of them here. I've got a great big long list of them. I'm going to mention a few of them, areas where judgments have to be rendered, and the complexity of these things sometimes need to conditions that change and are caused by, as I said, local governments and authority and seasons, time zones, whatever, international deadlines, global operations, Arctic and Antarctic circles, spacecraft orbiting the Earth, travel in space, climate, weather, migrations, economies, religious tolerance, wars, developing technologies, industry, labor-saving devices, private and commercial transportation, refueling, mediums of communication, advertising, sources of heat and power, conveniences, structures of business, automated vending machines, robotic machinery, automated processes, intraday international commerce, military support personnel and supplies, banking, compounding interest or compounding daily interest, international money instruments, stock exchanges, government bonds, mutual funds, communal acquisitions and ownership, national holidays, traditional holidays, holiday bonuses and gifts, taxes, fees, overhead uniforms, socialization, grooming, clothing styles, accessories, designs, piercings, tattoos, aging, diseases, health complications, medical practitioners, types of treatments, medicines, surgeries, discoveries of new species, genetic alterations, gender modification, changing music, modern works of art, carving images, restructured church organizations, governance modifications, on and on it goes. All of these areas of our lives sometimes require judgments to be made. If you haven't done so already, how do you make decisions on those things? Kind of challenging to think about. Being a judge is not an easy process, and yet Jesus Christ is going to ask each and every one of you to become a judge one day too. How will you execute judgment? Now you begin to see why our doctrinal committee stays busy, I think, in some ways, because there's always letters coming in and questions coming in about that are kind of complex as to how do I do this when this is the case. Those kinds of judgments have to be rendered. Work generally slows down when there's a change of administration. We change some of the people on board, and it always takes the new administration a little time to kind of catch up and get organized. And then the workflow starts again. While some members, and often those outside of United, may feel that they have a clear picture of such matters, from their perspective, the complexities involved in these kinds of things are sometimes well beyond their understanding. They don't realize that it does take time to make those kinds of judgments and decisions. And sometimes we're tempted to take shortcuts, and occasionally a letter gets written that maybe probably should have been reviewed before it does. But in order to save time, the individual maybe wrote one to try to move us ahead a little quicker without having to go through all the processes of the doctrinal committee. And sometimes we're tempted to do that just for the sake of time saving, but that's probably not a wise move, as we've discovered. But for these reasons, God has established a process for making judgments regarding how his church members are to keep his laws in unique circumstances. What are the decisions? Well, they're called judgments, as we've already said. Judgments are decisions handed down by judges to explain, to broaden or narrow the application of existing law. God instructs all judges who are responsible for making judgments, not specifically that are covered in the Torah or the first five books of Moses. In controversy, they shall stand as judges and judge it according to my judgments, he says. They shall keep my laws and my statutes, Ezekiel 44:24. He also tells Israel, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor, Leviticus 19:15. Taken together, God's laws, his statutes, and his judgments lay the foundation for a righteous society. And the administrative procedures that are needed or necessary in order to govern it. That's basically what the judgments are all about. And some of those statements are actually come from our booklet on the New Covenant, God's Laws and Statutes and Judgments. It's kind of good to review our booklets once in a while. You find out some interesting things that we've said that I didn't realize we had said. Making judgments on how the law of God can be or should be applied in unique situations is to be performed only by those whom God has assigned that role or that responsibility to. God made some judgments for the Israelites in combination with their impending entry into the promised land in Exodus 21 and verse 1. He mentions that specifically. Those were written down partly as an example to future judgment makers whom God would assign that responsibility to. Ezekiel 44:24 is one of the places where that assignment occurs. With the inception of the new covenant came a change of who he authorized for the church to place in later positions where they would be making judgments. Anybody know where that is in the New Testament? It's found in Hebrews. The Apostle Paul was very careful to show the transition from what was occurring in the church at the time. He wrote it to the Hebrews because most of them were heavily involved in the sacrificial and temple systems of the Aaronic priesthood that was still occurring in his day. But a time of change was occurring as the New Testament church was established and as the New Covenant was being established. And so Paul had to be very careful in terms of telling them this is how the administration is changing. And he does that in Hebrews 7. That whole chapter deals with a change in the ministry. And he shows how the Aaronic priesthood is now being replaced by the ministry of Jesus Christ, which is called the Melchizedek priesthood, which is a new covenant priesthood that is now taking the place of those of the seed of Aaron. And he takes very careful aim at changing that administration over and showing how the superiority of Jesus Christ's ministry is far beyond what could be done by the Aaronic priesthood. And then, of course, he transfers the responsibility for making judgments as well there. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, let me go over there and read that. I think it's worth reading that particular verse. Matthew 16, verse 19. Matthew 16, 19, "And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." This is Jesus Christ talking to specifically Peter here, although he does transfer this same authority to all the rest of the apostles a little bit later. But the responsibility was given by Christ to the apostles here and the ministers and leaders of the New Testament church. Now, who was the ministry of the church at this time? The apostles. There wasn't any other ministry. That was it. It is the ministry of the New Testament church at that point that Jesus Christ is transferring that authority. And if we look at the structure that Moses established in Israel, we find that it reserved all of the hard decisions, so to speak, were held by Moses himself. But he did delegate. His father-in-law Jethro suggested, you're too busy, you need to delegate some of these things down to people below you. So he established heads of thousands, heads of hundreds, heads of 50, and heads of 10, or heads of families, so to speak, all the way down the line. And he allowed those individuals to make judgments as they were needed by the people in their area. Whenever the judgment was too difficult to make or affected too many people, the judge over 10 would have to pass it up the line to the judge over 50. And if it was too difficult for him to make it, he would pass it up to the judge of 100. And if it was too difficult for him, he'd pass it up the line to the judge over 1,000. And then the judge over 1,000, if he couldn't make the decision or felt uneasy or insecure making it, he would take it to Moses. And Moses would then make those decisions. And so that's how the judgments were carried out. Jesus Christ delegates authority to his church to carry on two specific missions. And he gives that to the apostles at the end of Matthew and near the end of Mark and a number of other places as well. But the GCE is our highest authority in the church in terms of its delegation. It delegates authority to the COE, or the Council of Elders, to represent them in decisions. As it is inefficient and cumbersome to try to get all 400-plus members of the GCE together to make decisions. You know, we manage to do it once a year, but it's not an easy process to get everybody together to do that. So we delegate much of the activities that have to occur periodically throughout the year to the COE, and they basically make those decisions. Then they delegate the daily operations of the church over to the president, and the president then carries out that process, and he then delegates to three operational managers, the operational director for church administration, or church, which is called something else now, ministerial and member services, I believe is what we're calling it now, MMS. It's also the financial objectives are turned over to our treasurer, who's Aaron Dean at the moment. And the third area is media and the carrying out of basically what we consider to be the work or the preaching of the gospel. That ends up going to the third area, which right now is Mr. Peter Eddington. So things are delegated. They were delegated by Christ in the New Testament to the apostles. The apostles then had to delegate them to others as the years went by and the church grew as well. Let me ask, what are your opinions about how God's laws should be kept in the situations that I mentioned a while ago? We all want to see God's word kept. We all want to see his commandments kept. We all want to see people learn to obey God. But sometimes situations are so complex that it's very difficult to know what to tell people to do if they ask. And so judgments have to be rendered. When we understand that the decisions about each of them are to be made by those whom Christ set in authority in the church, our opinions become rather irrelevant, even though we might have certain opinions about how some things should be done. Judgments have been made for individual members who have been impacted by nearly all of the above issues that I talked about at one time or another in the church throughout its history. Ministers, including the Apostle Paul, Herbert W. Armstrong, our councils, and others assigned that task have sought God's will in seeking his understanding of these situations and how to deal with these matters. Yet members' responses to and opinions about those judgments sometimes don't recognize their validity. Yet God's thoughts are high above our heads. They aren't, you know, we don't think as he does. Isaiah 55, verse 9, talks about that. Our opinions don't compare to his. In Romans, Paul makes a comment about it as well in Romans 11, verses 33 and 34, that's worth reading. Romans 11, 33 and 34. Paul says, "How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out? For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor?" There are a lot of things that are kind of over our heads. That's why we tend to, in United, do things as a group rather than doing one or having one person making a lot of very important decisions. We try to work and seek consensus among a number of people. All of our booklets, all of our answers to people usually are reviewed by a number of people before we send them out. Sermons are reviewed before we put them on discs and mail them to the church areas to be listened to. We try to examine all that we're doing and have more than one person examine what we're doing so that we catch mistakes or we catch subtleties of misunderstanding that sometimes occur among any individual. Have our leaders always had the right judgment or the right decision? Well, clearly not. Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong had the church keeping Pentecost on Mondays for a long time. Did he always make the right decisions? Did he always make the right judgments? No. But the one thing about his heart and mind was that when he found out he was wrong, he changed it. And that's a, you know, as fine an attitude as one can expect among human beings. But in light of new information, he changed it to Sunday. You know, obviously he recognized his mistake. But men like him and men who followed him oftentimes came to the wrong understanding about things. And sometimes we taught certain things that really weren't what he taught. really weren't what the church taught. For many years, we were very, very much opposed to medical practices or anyone going to see a doctor. It got to the point where you couldn't take an aspirin without being criticized. Mr. Armstrong never taught that. A lot of people think he did. It was one who was in charge of the administration at the time underneath him who taught the ministry, and that's why we ended up with that. It didn't have anything to do with what Mr. Armstrong did or taught. In fact, Mr. Armstrong didn't know that it was being taught. Sometimes those things happen. For years, like men like Dr. Hay knew that we were keeping the wrong day for Pentecost. So what did he do? Did he jump out of the church and form another church? No. He understood that when Mr. Armstrong recognized the error, that he had the attitude that he would change it. And Dr. Hay presented material to him gradually over the years to try to introduce him to the fact that we were probably keeping Pentecost on the wrong day. But what did Dr. Hay do in the meantime? Well, he went to church on Monday with the rest of the church, dressed up, spoke, you know, kept Pentecost visibly before the members, but he also kept Sunday in his home, privately, quietly, not telling anybody what he was doing, because he knew it should be kept. Now, why did he do that? Well, he didn't want to cause division. He also didn't want to cause an uproar. He also wanted to take the time necessary to eventually present the materials to Mr. Armstrong, whose vision was not very good at the time. He had a lot of trouble reading, and there was a lot of technical reading that needed to be done in order to make that decision. And finally, Mr. Armstrong did see the light and understood what we were doing wrong, and he changed it. Dr. Hay did the right thing. There will probably never come a time until the kingdom is here and we're all changed into spirit where the members and the ministry all agree on every decision that is made in the church 100% of the time. It won't happen. Not while we're physical. So sometimes we just live with decisions that are made. That's all we can do. So should we get up and leave and start our own church? No, that's not an option. Not if you respect the authority that God has put in the church. I don't think we'll be making all of the right 100% decisions all the time until Christ returns. I'd like to see us make the right decisions in everything, but we don't always. Is that reason to leave? No. Does our leadership make mistakes? Yes, we're all human. Is that a reason to leave? No. Otherwise, we'd have no leadership. We'd have no church. We'd have no membership. If everybody decided, well, you know, so-and-so made a mistake, I'm out of here. You know, there wouldn't be any church. There wouldn't be any fellowship. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I have a story of my own to tell in this regard. I think that's kind of interesting. I'll use it as an example, too. In 2002, the church established a change in our understanding of the doctrine of born again. It was one of the last correct decisions that was rendered by Mr. Joseph DeConch Sr. after Mr. Armstrong's death. Mr. Armstrong told him that he would have to make the decision on it after he was gone, because Mr. Armstrong knew he could not read all of the technical material necessary to make that decision. So he handed it to Mr. DeConch before his death to make. And as United, we got around to publishing our paper on it finally in 2002. But while it was still controversial in the Worldwide Church of God, for a number of years, at least 2 years, I think, I kind of agonized over that decision. I knew we'd had it wrong. So did I leave and start my own church? No. That's not the right thing to do. I understood from the Greek and the New Testament that what we had taught regarding born again was not correct, and it was lacking, and eventually the church recognized that too. and we wrote a paper on it in 2002, correcting that misunderstanding. And I was relieved when we finally did. It was like, at last, we've got that one straightened out. And it takes time sometimes to get some of those judgments, some of those decisions made and rendered correctly. But I didn't consider leaving the church over the issue at all. I wanted to hopefully influence the church in moving that direction if I could, but I was not in a position to do very much influence. But I tried as best I could. Peter also was asked, let's go over to John. I don't remember if I've got the exact verse here. John chapter 6. There were issues that people left the church over. Jesus made the statement about, I believe in verse 58, "This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna who are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever. These things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. Therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, 'This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?' And when Jesus knew in himself that his disciples complained about this or were not fully in understanding of how do we eat your flesh and drink your blood? How is that possible? There was a lot of confusion. And he said to them in verse 61, 'Does this offend you? What then if you should see the Son of Man ascend where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak to you are spirit and they are life.'" You have to understand the figurative meaning of what I'm talking about. You don't eat my flesh and my blood literally. You eat it figuratively and spiritually. And he was trying to convey that to his disciples here, and many left him. It said something about, I don't know what verse it is here, I'm looking for it. In verse 67, he says, "Then Jesus said to the 12, 'Do you also want to go away?'" Okay, verse 66, "From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no longer with him." They couldn't take it. They didn't understand the meaning of some of the things that Jesus was trying to convey. Peter later made the statement to him, and Christ asked him, "Do you want to go away too?" Peter said, "Where shall we go? You have the words of life. Where else are we going to go? There's no place else to go." Just as when the church is obeying God, there is no other place to go either. Sometimes as human beings, we want God to make changes faster than he does. Sometimes he may want human beings to make changes faster than they do. But we as human beings sometimes don't respond at the speed that we should either. And we want him to make changes fast when we see that they need to be made. But that's part of building character and patience and faith, waiting sometimes. And we have to all do that. The real question for each of these, or for each of us, really becomes, will I submit to the authority that Christ has placed in his church and to the judgments he approves concerning lawful behavior? That's where it really boils down to it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Paul makes a comment about that. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And I'm sorry, I'm in 2 Corinthians. That's why I can't find his 16th chapter. 1 Corinthians 16. All right, 1 Corinthians 16, verses 15 and 16. "I urge you, brethren, you know the household of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have devoted themselves to the ministry of the saints, that you also submit to such, and to everyone who works and labors with us." here we see Paul, of course, is an apostle. He's appointing ministers in all these churches. And he's saying this happens to be one of those ministerial families in the churches that we should yield ourselves to. In Hebrews chapter 13, he says something very similar again. Hebrews 13, verse 17. Obey those who rule over you, and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls, as those who must give account. Let them do so with joy, and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. We have to decide, will I accept the authority Christ has placed in the church or not? Or will I reject that authority and the judgments and lean instead on my own understanding? That's the other option that we have as human beings. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 19 talks about that a little bit. Paul addresses it there. He also addresses it, or Peter addresses it in 1 Peter. Let me go read that one. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Christ is the head of the church. But he has also established authority in the church to make decisions too. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5. Solomon makes an interesting comment about it too. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. That's what gets us in trouble so often, is leaning to our own understanding. The latter mindset, of course, rapidly casts members adrift from the church as they go and seek and search of those opinions that match their own outside. And they drift away from the church, sadly. Sometimes we have to sit back, no matter how impatient we are, with those who may be in authority, and let them do their jobs. Let them do what's necessary. Whether making mistakes or not, they are the ones God holds responsible for those mistakes. You and I are responsible to leave, and it's not our responsibility to leave the church and to start our own church. It's our responsibility to respond to the church, or be responsive in that regard. While we should have great concern, I think, for proper obedience of God's laws, our own understanding does not compare to God's laws and to what God has in mind. Clearly, some of the things that God did in the Old Testament, we often wonder, well, how does that equate to God's law? How could God ask Abraham to sacrifice his own son when human sacrifice was abhorrent to God? Why would he do that? I think we have to understand that God stopped him, but he had to find out what his attitude was. It wasn't that God was actually going to let him go through with it. It wasn't that God was asking him to do something that was unlawful for God. God has given life. He can take life, and he can choose whom to take it with. But it is God's decision. Genesis 22:2 talks about him sacrificing his son, nor that he should offer up his own son. We also find in the book of John, John 3:16, it talks about God who gave his only begotten son to us for the sacrifice that was necessary for human beings. Hebrews 11:17 talks about the same thing. We know now that it was not God's will or intent for Abraham to actually take the life of his son. But he had to see where Abraham's heart and his loyalties were. And through obedience to those judgments, both Abraham and Isaac demonstrated submission to the will of God. And they, of course, then became the fathers of the faithful. Those judgments in unique circumstances stand in stark contrast to those would-be wolves who would sanction violations of God's law, Romans 1:32. false teachers will be in the church. Matthew 7:15 confirms it. So you remain responsible to ensure that you follow only the directors of teachers who have the fruits of God's Spirit, who are submissive to Jesus Christ's true ministry. John 10:27. A number of these verses I'd like to read. I just don't have time to go to all of them. There's never really any excuse for anyone following permissive or self-promoting or divisive judgments made by wolves. Philippians chapter 2, verse 12 tells us that we'll know the difference. We'll distinguish the difference. Proper judgments will always promote the keeping of spiritual intent, or the spiritual intent of God's laws, which is obedience to God and love for Him and one's neighbor as well. Mark chapter 12, verse 33. While working around unique complexities that require godly wisdom for decision making, it is the church's responsibility to carry these things out and to make the judgments. And those judgments then need to be made under the umbrella of God's law when unique circumstances create complex issues or decisions have to be made. Some have written demanding the opinion of our doctrinal committee about business operations and about, in another hemisphere, about some of the things that we do and some of the decisions we've made overseas. The doctrinal committee of the council is responsible to make those decisions on behalf of the council, who will, as a whole, approve or disapprove them. Now, I realize that sometimes we get a little ahead of ourselves and we move a little too fast, and we maybe write a letter to settle an issue when it maybe needed to be considered a little bit more thoroughly before we did. But those are mistakes that any administration can make. And hopefully, we learn from those, and we don't make them anymore. But the doctrinal committee of the council is responsible to make those decisions on behalf of the council. Who will approve or who will disapprove them or whatever. They're involved in that process. While such a matter needs to have a judgment made by the church, it needs to be made by those whom Christ is assigned to make it. And whatever the judgment is, Christ will back it. Bind it in heaven if it is proper and if it's the appropriate thing to be done in those circumstances and at that moment in time. Not that I mean to say that every decision is perfect. Certainly we make lots of decisions that aren't perfect and are flawed. Usually we learn from them and we sometimes reverse them, sometimes change them. Resolutions that are made by the council sometimes have to be thrown out and a new resolution made from time to time, as we find out that this maybe isn't the best course of action. This isn't the best approach to take. And we change our approach. And the council changes its approach from time to time as well. But if it's imperfect, it will eventually be corrected. The council or the church will change it. We will see those changes made when they need to be changed. In the meantime, they become sometimes a little bit of a test of our attitude, too, don't they? And so we have a response and have a realization that maybe I should sit back and think about this a little bit more before I get too upset. After any opinion, including mine or yours, that runs contrary to the judgment, ultimately becomes an opposition to what's been decided. We don't want to be in the position where we're opposing the church. Matthew 18:18 talks about that a little bit. I'll read it. Matthew 18 and verse 18. Assuredly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That's part of understanding that certain things are bound in heaven. The right decisions when we make them are certainly bound. Consequently, opinions which run contrary to the church's decisions are something we don't want to become involved in. They become irrelevant and sometimes insubordinate. In Titus chapter 1, Paul addresses that briefly. In Titus chapter 1, verse 9, He says, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who are, or those who contradict. This is one of the functions of the ministry, holding fast the doctrinal word or the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict, those who are not in agreement, whose mouths, in verse 11, must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things that they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. To summarize, due to ever-changing complex situations in this life and on this planet as human beings, God establishes the process of making judgments. There'll always be a factor when there are human beings. I mean, that's just simply the way it is. God gives his law in a general state. Sometimes human beings encounter situations where they don't know how to keep it or keep it properly, and judgments have to be made. And they sometimes are made for individual circumstances, sometimes for a broader policy, sometimes become study papers, sometimes they become they remain in force, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they change with varying circumstances. Acts chapter 15, verse 29 gives an example of that. But let's go to 1 Corinthians. That's where I want to go. 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Excuse me. 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 4. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 4. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. Paul's talking about the fact that Christians understand that idols aren't something that are real. They are real to the Gentiles who believe in idol worship, but they aren't real. And we know they don't represent gods that are real. They simply aren't gods. Therefore, eating food that has been offered to them, as Paul said, didn't bother him, but he would if it bothered someone who had been involved in idol worship before coming into the church, and they were bothered by seeing someone in the church eating it, that Paul wouldn't eat that food in front of them, or that meat in front of them. The crucial factor is that God approves the judgments made by those he appoints to make them. And Paul was making one right here regarding food offered to idols. Paul made a number. He talked about the issue of long hair in 1 Corinthians 11. He made decisions about a number of things, about offerings. He made decisions about many things in his works in the Bible. And God upholds those things. They've become part of Scripture. Those judgments are just as valid today as they were then. In such matters, other opinions are opposition. They become a form of rebellion to what God has approved. And in this age of criticism of leadership and lack of submission to authority, our mentality can gravitate to that of societies and be in conflict or be in question about anyone or anything who is in authority. And believe me, this world is very questioning of anybody who is in any position of authority. The world questions it from the bottom to the top, and especially the media. Scripture warns us to have no association with such people. And Paul is the one who said it in 2 Timothy. Let's go look at it. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. He gives this warning in the last book that Paul wrote. He's talking to a minister under him, Timothy. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasures rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. We're not to have association with such people. We each need to be diligent to be known by God as one who is submissive, who is willing to perform his will, who is willing to submit themselves to him and the authority he's established. John 12:26, there's a number of verses that talk about that. You know, if God isn't moving fast enough to straighten out what's going on in the church for us, maybe we should just get on our high horse and straighten it out ourselves, right? Well, obviously not. We can simply act like Moses. We can strike the rock twice, get the water to come out, and then we'll go back and ask God what he wants to do. Moses suffered for that. He moved a little faster than God was ready to move. He made a decision before God was ready to make it. Sometimes we have to learn lessons like that and realize that sometimes our will wants to move faster than God's will does. We can ask God, but we have to patiently wait for him to give an answer. We can't just jump in there and make the decision ourselves. And one who is a productive member of Christ's body, who is a member of the church, in Ephesians 4:16, it defines us as members of that body, we will show our fruits. We will show our patience. We will show our submissiveness to authority. Diligence in doing so will bear godly fruit for the kingdom. 2 Peter 1, verses 10 through 11. Peter talks about that too. And you will enter his eternal rest, as it is said in Hebrews 4:11. I hope this kind of clarifies the subject of judgments and judgments in the church today and the fact that the church does have the authority to make decisions involving some of us sometimes, decisions we might like, we might not like some from time to time. But we have to be submissive to them. For some, it will just have been a review, maybe, but for others, newer members perhaps, it will make the scriptures come alive, I think, in today's world. Today's world is so critical of anything or anyone in authority. And they, of course, criticize churches because churches usually do represent a form of authority, especially the Catholic Church. They're open to criticism from the media all the time. But we have to realize that there's a reason for that. This is Satan's society, and Satan is critical of authority. Why do you think he rebelled against God in the first place? And what do you think he would like for you and I to do as well? He'd like for us to rebel against any judgments that are made by the church or the authority in the church too.